Hi everyone, my name is Parker Butler and this is Politics with Parker, Season 2, Episode 17. In this weekly series, I break down the latest political news and offer some commentary on how to get people, especially young people, engaged in politics and energized about the issues that we as a generation are going to inherit. Well, 2018 has arrived, and that means that it is midterms year. Candidates up and down the ballot are running in primaries and preparing for general elections. The battle for control of Congress, particularly the House of Representatives, is sure to be a contentious one. Organizations like the Democratic one called Swing Left have launched national efforts to influence the hundreds of House races across the country, and they've used analyses and polling data to determine the ones that are going to be the closest. One of those is Texas's 32nd District, which includes areas of North Dallas like Richardson, Garland, Wiley, and Highland Park. Now, the Republican incumbent, Pete Sessions, has been an incumbent for decades and has voted heavily conservative on both social and economic issues, while the district itself has drifted towards the center. The Democratic primary to decide who runs against Sessions is a crowded one, and there are two front-runners, both of whom are former Obama administration officials. One of them is Colin Allred, and on top of his credentials in the federal government, he's also a former NFL linebacker and an attorney. Now, this week, I interviewed him on a number of issues to get a better understanding of how he sees this election and how he, if he were to be elected, would represent his district. So I just want to start just by getting to know a little bit more about you as a candidate. And so I've just got to start with the most cliche question, which is, but it's very important. And that is, what made you decide to run? And also, why now? Why this cycle in particular?
Yeah, well, you know, Parker, this is my home. I was actually born in a hospital in this district, grew up in this district. And everything that I've done, whether it's playing in the NFL or becoming a civil rights attorney or working for the president of the United States has all kind of been built on the foundation that I got here. Growing up here, I was raised by a single mother who was a public school teacher. My mom taught in Dallas Public Schools, and I went to Dallas Public Schools, graduating from Hillcrest High School. And I had a lot of help along the way. And because of the people of North Texas, I was able to do all of the things that I've done. And so I want to give back to those folks. And I think that we can do a lot better. And I think that Pete Sessions, I disagree with him on almost every policy issue, but what I really disagree with him on is I don't think he respects the people of this area. I don't think he comes back and talks to us. I don't think he explains what he's doing to us. I think that he is largely bought and paid for. And so I think that this is a critical time for our country. I think 2018 is the most important election of our lifetime because if we don't reject what's been going on, not only in this White House, but in this Congress, kind of the naked greed and some of the hatred and fear that has been tapped into and used as a political wedge issues. If we don't reject that here in 2018, we're going to get a lot more of it, and it's going to get worse. So it's important not just to replace Republicans with Democrats, but to kind of restore sanity and some stability to our government.
All right. You've served in the Department of Housing in the Obama administration alongside Mr. Julian Castro. And you also served as a civil rights attorney, but this is your first campaign for public office. Is that right?
It is.
All right. So let's assume that you win the nomination on March 6th. Your Republican opponent, Pete Sessions, he's held the seat for 15 years. What do you think makes having fresh faces in Congress so important as opposed to the long-term incumbents like Mr. Sessions?
You know, I think it's natural and good for all organizations, whether it's government or any organization, to have fresh blood come in every now and then that sees things differently, that kind of has a different perspective on what that organization is doing. And Congress is no different. I think it's a problem that so many of our members of Congress are seemingly there for lifelong sentences. You know, I mean, Pete Sessions has been in office for a long time, and I think that he has lost track probably of why he got into this. And I think he's certainly lost touch with the people of this area. And when I go around and talk to folks here in North Texas, I feel not only a hunger to have, you know, to get rid of Pete Sessions and replace him with a Democrat, but for a new generation of leadership that kind of sees things differently. You know, I see running for office as being about public service. I think we have to go back to kind of that model of servant leadership that we have gotten away from in this Congress. And we have to do it now, especially under kind of the presidency of an unstable and I think unfit president.
Okay. Your district, the 32nd district, has historically been pretty red, but it did go for Secretary Hillary Clinton in 2016. And also, I might add that not a single Democrat actually filed to run for Congress in this same district in 2016, despite Clinton winning the district. But now there are upwards of 10 candidates running for that same seat this year. And you've been on the ground talking with voters, so you know the district. Like you said, you were born and raised in the district. Are you seeing firsthand the formation of that same Democratic blue wave that we've been hearing about nationally?
I think so. I mean, I think that waves have often had a hard time reaching Texas because we have gerrymandered districts that make it difficult to win, and we make it very difficult for people to vote in this state. You know, as a voting rights attorney, I've dealt with that pretty extensively. But I do think that the conditions are right because there are a lot of organizations and groups that have popped up and that exist now that didn't exist before the election. I got to tell you, the thing I love most about my campaign is the number of young people who are involved in our campaign. Mm-hmm. We have a fellows program that kind of lets young people come in, get a full view of what we do on the campaign, and they have really added a ton to this. And, you know, I think they're going to go forward and they're going to be leaders of this community long after this race is over. And so I'm really proud of that. I think it's going to make a difference, not only in this election, but I think it's going to be really great for the area.
All right, that's awesome. Moving on to policy, there are so many issues that can be talked about that you stand in such a stark contrast to Mr. Sessions, and one of those is healthcare. But I want to sort of pinpoint your position more clearly, though. Sessions has repeatedly voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act. He has voted for the replacement plans last year that would have uninsured tens of millions of Americans and also undermined protections for pre-existing conditions. But on the Democratic side, there's a wider spectrum of viewpoints. And I know that you came out in favor of a Medicare for All single-payer system, which is something that the Democratic leadership in Congress is not particularly united on. And so for you as a candidate in a sort of swing, sort of center-right district to come out in favor of a policy that is pretty significant. So do you think that Democrats should unite behind Medicare for All to give people a clearer contrast to Republicans?
You know, Medicare for All and providing health care to everyone in this country has been a Democratic goal since Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, this is like, honestly, like one of the bases of our party. We've always talked about getting to universal coverage. You know, Harry Truman introduced a national health care system, you know, after the war because he thought that we needed to have more people who are eligible and healthy to serve in the military. He saw it as a national security issue. And so, I mean, this is a long-running value of the Democratic Party. Whether or not Democratic leadership wants to get behind that and actually fight for the things that I think most of the people in our party believe, that's up to them. But this is part of why we need a new generation of leadership, not just to have Democrats come in to replace Republicans. We need to have new folks come in also into the Democratic Party to kind of push us and make us fight for the things that we do believe in, that we've believed in for a long time. You know, when I talk about Medicare for All, I'm really talking about allowing everyone to get into the Medicare system. So it's not specifically kind of what you might have seen from Bernie Sanders or something like that. But either way, mm-hmm. we have to get to universal coverage. We have a healthcare crisis in Dallas. In Dallas County, 1 in 5 people don't have health insurance. In Texas, 1 in 6 people don't have health insurance. That's the highest rate in the nation. Mm-hmm. So if I'm trying to take care of the people in my area, I have to focus on the issues that we have. And one of them, and the biggest one, is providing health care to everyone.
All right. So moving on to another issue that has been in the news a ton lately and has gotten younger people in particular very heated and engaged because it directly and in many ways disproportionately affects us, and that is net neutrality. Pete Sessions, just like Ted Cruz and Trump, he doesn't support net neutrality. Where do you stand on it? And also, should Congress take action to overturn the FCC's decision?
Absolutely. Congress has to step into this. This is way too important of a decision to leave to a group of unelected bureaucrats who sit on the FCC panel there. The idea that we will allow these mega internet service providers to throttle and really slow down access for groups depending on whether or not they're able to purchase access is, to me, just insane. You know, the next great American idea will almost certainly happen online or use the internet. And we need to make sure that there are no barriers or obstacles in the way of that person doing that. You know, when Mark Zuckerberg started Facebook in his garage or wherever it was, he didn't have to go to Comcast or AT&T and get ask for permission to set this up, even though it's going to use a lot of bandwidth, even though it's going to be something that was going to be really heavily trafficked. He didn't have to do that. It was an open internet. He was able to just get online and people could come to him. Without net neutrality, I'm really concerned that some of these mega internet service providers will be allowed to throttle that and to make and to kind of change the way we get online and who can get online and change what content you have access to. And that's something that Congress has to vote for. And if your member of Congress isn't willing to vote for it, we should be asking them as young people specifically, why don't you stand for this? Why won't you keep the internet open and free?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about LGBT rights, because I think it's another issue where your opponent has been incredibly conservative on when, as you said in a different interview, it doesn't seem that his district is nearly as conservative as he's voting. And so, you know, he voted for a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. He voted to ban same-sex adoptions, etc. And so the American Civil Liberties Union actually gives Sessions a 7% rating. And so if you win the nomination, how do you intend on getting the word out about his record and sort of framing it in a way that's not red versus blue, but is instead, in your view, you know, reasonable person versus, you know, on issues like this, extremist?
Yeah, I actually think that's a great question, Parker, by the way. I think that this is all about, like, deeply held American values of equality for everyone, justice for everyone, that everyone should be able to pursue their version of the American dream, right? We all agree on that. We're trained in that. That's part of our culture as Americans. Mm-hmm. And it's so against that culture and against those American values to think that we're going to treat a subset of our citizens and our people differently because of who they love or who they want to, you know, form a lasting relationship with. I to me, it's the exact opposite of everything we stand for. I actually, you know, this is one of the things I enjoy about talking to young people, is that we are almost all in agreement about this. There's very little disagreement about this among, you know, millennials, folks who are, you know, young people trying to get involved. The only area of disagreement there is with older folks who just have not come around to this and who have been kind of holding on to this this idea, you know, that they're going to be able to tell other people whether who they can marry and who they can love.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's an anti-American thing, and I don't think it's a partisan thing. You know, I think there are young Republicans who feel this way too. I think it's a generational thing, and I think that we have to do everything we can to not only stand up to the policies that discriminate against people who are LGBTQ. For example, you can still get married on a Saturday and be fired on a Monday for marrying the person you love. We have to stand up to the rhetoric and the way that we talk about this, because it's just, to me, it's unbelievable that we're still having this conversation in 2018.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, it's more moral than it is policy, really. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a political issue. I mean, people don't think about who they're going to vote for when they want to get married or when they fall in love. That doesn't come into their mind.
Yeah.
This is about whether or not we're going to allow people to pursue their full lives as American or as Americans, or whether or not we're going to restrict it. And if you're in favor of restricting it, I think you should have to explain why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So moving on to immigration, right now the DACA program for immigrant youth is being used as a negotiating tool for Donald Trump to get his precious border wall. Let's say that you're in Congress and congressional Republicans say that they want the money for the wall, and in return, they'll keep the protections for the 800,000 Dreamers in the U.S. Would you agree to it?
Parker, you're asking some great questions, man. No, I wouldn't. No, I'm not trading you know, DACA or the DREAM Act for a wall that we don't want, that we don't need, that is a waste of money. The Republicans need to do the right thing. President Trump earlier in his term said that he was in favor of protecting these young people. And I think that there's consensus among Republicans that we should do something and that we should do the right thing here. They are just afraid of their own political base getting mad at them for, you know, expanding this protection to these young folks who have come here through no fault of their own, who are serving in our military, who are contributing to our economy, who are teaching in our schools. They're every bit as American as you and I are. And they deserve to be allowed to stay here and to build their lives here. This is the only country that they've ever known. You know, and I'm not going to trade that in favor of what I think will be a racist symbol that won't do its task. It won't stop you know, undocumented immigration, because walls have never worked, number one. Number two, it's an enormous waste of money, an enormous waste of money. And number three, I think it will be a racist symbol that will not, you know, we can't trade the Statue of Liberty for a wall with barbed wire on the top of it. The symbol of America has to remain the Statue of Liberty, and if we ever lose that, then we've lost something much more important than a single policy issue.
All right. So you were a voting rights litigator in Dallas, is that right?
Well, I've done my litigation work all over the country, but yeah.
Okay. Last week, Trump's what he calls his voter fraud commission was dissolved after many states refused to comply with their request for voter registration data. Do you think that there was an underlying intention behind Trump's commission that he set up? And also, what is your take on his claims about the millions of illegal votes that were cast in the 2016 election?
Parker, man, we're going to have to get your resume into this since we can submit it to the Dallas Morning News or something. These are really good questions. Okay. I mean, the Voter Fraud Commission was a sham commission that was set up to justify a lie by the President of the United States, which was that he lost the popular vote because 3 million, as he said, his words, illegal immigrants voted in the election. That is absolutely not true. It's a lie. Republicans at the time when he said it knew it was a lie and said that it was a lie. The fact that we have allowed this president to just get away with openly lying like this is, to me, one of the things that we have to be very on guard for, because we can't allow ourselves to slip into a place where we just accept lying from the President of the United States. And it's also been a huge waste of money. And, you know, to go back to what we're talking about, the wall, it's just a political stunt that has not done nothing. And I think the intention behind it, led by Kris Kobach, who, if you don't know who he is, you should look into kind of his history of trying to suppress the vote. It was led by him as an effort to try and find ways to make it much more difficult to vote. Because the truth behind this is that there's a segment of the Republican Party that does not want the majority of Americans to vote, because they are afraid that their policies and their politics and what they stand for is not popular enough to win an election. So they want to fix who votes so that they can keep and stay in power by not allowing the people to vote who disagree with them. And a lot of those folks are young people. They're people of color. They're people who move often. They're people who sometimes who are seniors who have some difficulties, you know, complying with some of these laws. And the intention behind it is to make it harder to vote. And in this country, in the greatest democracy in the history of the world, we have to be making it easier to vote every single day until we get to the kind of voter participation that we need, not harder. And so I think it's the exact wrong idea.
All right. And moving on to the major tax bill that was passed just a few weeks ago, aside from some of the major controversial components, I've seen some concern in places like the 32nd District about things like property taxes. What's your take on the new law? Is it completely disastrous, or are there some things that, for a Democrat, are justifiable?
It's almost completely disastrous. It's a law that was written by lobbyists. The Republicans who voted for it didn't even read it. If you look at Pete Sessions afterwards, after voting for it, he wanted to try and take back one of the provisions that was going to tax, graduate students. Because he didn't realize, I guess, that was in there. You know, and so it's like, oh no, now we want to go out and try and fix it. It's like, well, you should have read that before you voted for it.
Yeah.
I think it's a piece of social engineering. Really, it's a donor appreciation bill. It's trying to give transfer wealth from the middle class and people struggling to get into the middle class to the ultra wealthy and to corporations. You know, in a time where corporate profits are through the roof, we have record corporate profits. That's not the time when you need to cut the corporate tax rate. There are things that we could have done, like maybe easing the tax rate for small businesses that are trying to get off the ground, maybe making it easier to invest in a small business. But that's not what they did. You know, they did an across-the-board giant cut that is going to help the biggest corporations much more than it will help any of those small businesses that actually drive our wage growth. You know, and the state and local income tax credit that they got rid of is really, really crazy, because it's a huge tax increase for people who are in areas that have high local taxes, areas that have high state taxes. And, you know, what are those taxes paying for? They're paying for our roads. They're paying for our schools. They're paying, in our case here in Dallas County, to keep Parkland Hospital going, where it's dealing with a huge number of uninsured people coming in every day. That we're all paying for their health care when they're at the worst part of whatever illness they're dealing with. So this bill, to me, is just an unbelievable, just naked grab for money, for the donors who give money to these politicians. And it's one of the best examples, I think, of why Pete Sessions has to go and why just a whole generation of these folks need to go and allow some people to come in who actually care about their constituents.
And moving it to a larger point, you know, you've used words to describe Mr. Sessions bought out. You refer to the tax bill as donor appreciation. Would you support a constitutional amendment to get money out of politics?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is something that I think that we have probably not paid as much attention to, you know, nationally, and not made this as big an issue as it is. The amount of money that is flooded into our politics and that distorts our political system is just unbelievable and unacceptable. So we need to overturn Citizens United, which was a terrible ruling of the Supreme Court. Not only did it say that corporations are people, but that corporations are people that have you know, First Amendment rights to talk in our elections, and that they can use those rights to drown out all the other folks out there who maybe don't have as much resources or don't have as much money. You know, and I think it's just crazy. You know, it allows money to come into this country, into our elections, that we don't even know where it's coming from. It literally could have been paid for by Russia, you know, some of these things. And so the Citizens United ruling is a huge, huge mistake. But we also, I think, need to go further, because the way we just fund campaigns is to me, broken. I would love to see us implement a public financing system to allow, you know, every candidate to have access to a baseline of funds so that they can run for office. That would reduce the percentage of members of Congress who are millionaires. Right now, I think it's over half of the members of Congress are millionaires. You shouldn't have to be a millionaire to run for Congress. You know, you should be somebody who cares about your area and is going to be an advocate for your area. And so we got to do a lot more to get money out of our politics and to take out the corrupting effect that happens when you're getting so much money from an individual person when they obviously are going to want something in return.
Yeah, and I mean, I was talking with some students at my own school, and they were surprised by how drastic these laws of money in politics are. I told them, you know, they're asking why net neutrality was ruled the way it was, and I was like, well, it probably has something to do with the lobbyists who influenced the FCC. And they said, well, isn't that bribery? Isn't that illegal? And I said, no, that's how the system has been, you know, set up. So as a former Obama administration official, you are running in a primary with another Obama administration official, Ed Meyer. For the undecided person walking into the polling booth on March 6th, and they see your names on the ballot, what would you tell them that would set yourself apart as to why you are uniquely qualified to take on Sessions in the general election?
You know, I think we have to have a story to tell as Democrats. You know, they say that Republicans fall in line and Democrats fall in love, right? Mm-hmm. And to our biggest problem in Texas and our biggest problem in this district isn't that there are too many Republicans. It's that we don't have enough people voting. Enough mm-hmm. people don't come out to vote. And when voter turnout goes up, Democrats do well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to have a candidate who's able to, you know, speak to those folks who aren't voting, who has a story to tell and has a vision of where we should go as a country that will appeal enough to get people out to vote who have a whole lot of other things competing for their time and for their attention. And, you know, as a former NFL player, as a civil rights attorney, someone who worked with President Obama, as someone who was born and raised in this district by a single mother, I think I have a story to tell about who we are here in North Texas and where we should go together as a community that nobody else in this race can tell. And I think that story is going to allow us to reach folks who maybe have a lot of other things on their mind, like how are they going to pay for the bills? You know, how are they going to take care of grandma who's sick? How are they going to replace that car that needs to be replaced? That's what we're competing against to get people out to vote here in Texas. And it requires some excitement. It requires a candidate who can get people involved who haven't always been involved. And we've already done that in my campaign. You know, and I think that we as Democrats have to look for and get behind candidates who can get folks excited, especially here in Texas, because our biggest issue, we're 49th in the country in voting. Our biggest issue isn't that we're a red state, it's that we're a non-voting state. And to grow that pie, we have to have compelling candidates with compelling stories and with visions for the future. And I think that's what I have, and I think that's why folks should vote for me.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we're almost done. Just last question. What can people do who are listening to this and they support what you're saying? They want to see change in North Texas's representation in Congress. What can they do to help your campaign and these causes between now and November?
Well, first of all, you can go to my website. It's colinallred.com. It's one L in Colin, and then all red is A-L-L-R-E-D. Go to our website, sign up to get involved, sign up to volunteer with us. If you're interested in becoming a fellow, click on our fellowship application. You will get involved in our campaign. You'll see everything that we do. There are no closed doors in our campaign. If you speak to any of our fellows, they'll tell you that. You will see everything we do from the finance side to the field side to the press side. you know, you can get a full view. And that way, when you're ready, you can run for office too. And then, of course, I'd love you to follow me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, follow me on all the social media channels, Instagram. I'm calling All Red TX. We'd love to have you help spread our message. And, you know, come out to one of our events and see me in person. See that the people who come to our events look like this district. It's a lot of young people. It's families. It's people of every race, every national origin, every religion. I think it's the thing that I'm most excited about, the thing that I'm most pleased about, is that we've put together a group of supporters and a base of folks that is extremely diverse and that's young and it's fun and it's ready for change. And if you want to be a part of that, we'd love to have you.
And that was my interview with congressional candidate Colin Allred. Now, I'm looking to interview more candidates in the future who are running for positions up and down the ballot, and the offer still stands for the incumbent, Mr. Pete Sessions, if he'd like to come on the show and defend his own record. I can tell you I certainly have some questions for him. Now, finally, remember the 2018 primaries in Texas are on March 6th. If you plan to vote for any candidate, you'll need to make sure that you are registered by February 5th. That's all I've got for this week. My name is Parker Butler, and thank you for listening.